This is Rabbi Sharon Brous, Rabbi at Ikar, where we're dedicated to reinvigorating Jewish community, ritual, and learning, all while laying the foundation for a just and loving society. You're listening to Ikar's podcast, where you can hear our sermons from Shabbat and holidays, our teachings, our guest speakers, basically anything we think worth hearing that we can capture and stream, you can listen to right here. The whole Megillah. I mean, literally, the whole Megillah. So thank you so much for being with us. In the storm of storms, in the year of darkness, it was my heart that spoke out and said, I can't break anymore. I don't have it in me. My friend Bradley Burson wrote these words a few weeks ago from his home in Yafo, that beautiful biblical port town at the southern tip of Tel Aviv, where Jewish Israelis and Palestinian citizens of Israel, neighbors, eat in the same restaurants and walk together through the narrow cobblestone streets of the old city, peering out at the port from which the prophet Jonah boarded a ship in a desperate attempt to do anything but heed God's command that he bring prophecy to the people of Nineveh. My heart spoke out and said, I can't break anymore. I don't have it in me. I feel Bradley's words in my throat. I feel it in my chest. I feel it in my belly. There is so much sorrow. There's so much fear. There is so much anguish. Everything is broken. We cannot break anymore. There's a wonderful journalist who's writing a profile piece on Ikar, and he asked me this week to walk him through a typical day in my life. I described my morning run, getting the kids out to school, joining morning minion, and then 8 to 10 hours of meetings, pastoral counsel for the brokenhearted, interviews, podcasts, and book talks, team meetings for dreaming and planning and strategizing about our beautiful community, and of course, teaching and preaching, and if I'm lucky, a little bit of learning too. But I realized when he left my office that I could just as easily have answered his question, not with a literal, but instead with a spiritual and emotional mapping of my day, which these days feels like repeated puncture wounds to my already shattered heart. My day starts with heartache. I awaken to an alert of the death of another Israeli soldier in Gaza. This time a 21-year-old from central Israel, his family now bereft forever that their son and brother is gone. Then heartache when I turn on the daily to hear heightened warnings of a looming famine in Gaza, where children have already begun dying from malnutrition, where desperate mothers tell stories of how they're feeding their family animal feed in order to keep them alive. Then heartache, when I later read that some Israeli officials deny that there's a catastrophic food shortage altogether. There is no hunger in Gaza, one official said. Heartache later that morning when I sit down to read about the extent that some people will go to diminish, disregard, or outright deny evidence that Hamas committed systematic rape on October 7th. And likely since then, against those who are being held hostage. Heartache over the months of near total silence from friends and colleagues in the women's rights movement, from the United Nations, and from others whose mission is ostensibly to protect women, unless it appears those women are Israeli. Heartache in a midday meeting when I hear about my friend's synagogue being blocked from participating now in a climate justice conference because the rabbi has failed to sufficiently denounce Israel, or as the former allies call it, the Zionist entity, because somehow saying the word Israel would render Israel an actuality rather than just a colonialist fantasy. Heartache when, while speaking about my book, I hear from Jewish university students about their experience these past several months. One, a secular Jew who didn't find a home for herself at Hillel, so she started hosting Shabbat dinners in her co-op for other students who wanted to come together and cook together and connect with Jewish rituals. Hillel on campus heard about these dinners, and because their core objective is to foster Jewish life on campus, they offered her some discretionary funding to pay for the meal so she didn't have to go out of pocket, no strings attached. But then after October 7th, this student was brought before a tribunal in her co-op and told that she either had to denounce Hillel and its Zionist money, or she could no longer live in co-op housing. She moved out. It's the same heartache when I read in Mariv that parts of London are now unofficially dubbed no-go zones for Jews, where they just can't be kept safe among pro-Palestinian demonstrators. And when I saw this week the latest round of anti-Semitic propaganda material making the rounds at my kids' university, material that would have made Joseph Goebbels giddy with admiration. And then heartache, when I read later that afternoon an update on Hisham Aratini, one of three Palestinian college students shot in Vermont this past winter. Two of them have recovered fully, but Hisham, a student at Brown, is paralyzed now from the waist down. I'm stunned by his resiliency, but also heartbroken as I hear him explain that growing up Palestinian, you, quote, learn fairly quickly that life is absurd and you'll get screwed over. And you know, you just have to suck it up and keep moving forward. I can understand Bradley Burstyn's broken heart because I myself am thrust hourly from one story of untold grief to another. We're stuck in an endless loop of human heartache and it is breaking us. I heard an interview this week with Yuval Noah Harari, the brilliant Israeli public intellectual. Listen to what he says. If you look at the major conflicts and injustices in the world, it's ultimately about the stories that we believe. We are a storytelling animal. Some people think that humans fight over the same reasons that other animals fight, over territory and over food, but this is rarely the case. Think, he said, about the terrible conflict in my region of the world between Israelis and Palestinians. There is enough land to build enough houses and hospitals and schools for everyone. There is enough food to feed everyone. People fight over the imaginary stories in their minds. Who is God's favorite? Who did God give these holy stones to? This is what most conflicts in the world, Harari says, are actually about. And that's actually good news, because if conflicts are about objective things, the only way to end them is through violence. But if conflicts are about the stories that we believe, there is a chance, at least in some cases, there is a chance that we can perhaps change the story. We can find a common story that we can both be happy about. And of course, Harari is right. We need a new story. We need a redemptive story. The question is, do we have the capacity to write it? The Torah models for us redemptive storytelling again and again. Take a look at the story of the Mishkan, the holy place in the desert, a sanctuary from the wild beasts and lawlessness and fear and doubt of the wilderness. The intricate description of its design does more than model the profound care that must be taken in crafting sacred space. What we read about here takes on a different meaning, a deeper meaning, because the Mishkan, that sacred tabernacle, is not only the story of the creation of something beautiful, but it is the creation of something holy, a tikkun, a redemption, after the creation of something profoundly unholy. Rashi and many others point out that the building of the Mishkan serves as an atonement for Chet HaEgel, for the sin of the golden calf. Those who came together to do harm can now come together to do good. The moral order, upended by moral and spiritual failing, can only be restored when the same community gathers its resources to build a counter-testimony to what they built before. There's always a redemptive possibility, the text seems to be saying to us. We could not have seen it in the immediate chaos of the golden calf, but that terrible incident gave rise to something absolutely wondrous, so wondrous that we're still talking about it today, thousands of years later. And there's a deeper subtler, more revolutionary story being told here as well. The chief architect of that most sacred space is called Bezalel, the young artist endowed with a divine spirit, with wisdom and insight and knowledge. But Bezalel is not only a gifted artist. There are three elements to his story that must be noted. First, we learn in the Talmud that Bezalel was, when he was chosen by God for this sacred role, only 13 years old. He was a bar mitzvah boy. And even still, already in his short life, he possessed the wisdom and the sensitivity to tell a counter story for his people, to realize the holy aspirations of the Israelites in physical form. Second, and maybe even more remarkably, Bezalel's entire childhood was spent in enslavement in Egypt. And only months after the people finally emerged from that dark and narrow place, this child was charged with creating the most magnificent work of art, with creating the Mishkan. What a wonder that a person who has known only suffering and oppression could muster not only artistic skill, but imagination. Listen to the story that is being told here. Even people raised in the narrowest of constraints can still somehow dream the most expansive possibilities. And that is not all. Bezalel is not only a child, and he's not only a former slave, he is the inheritor of a story of tremendous heartache. We read twice in the Torah that Bezalel was called by God, son of Uri, son of Hur. Why repeat his lineage twice? Because Bezalel's grandfather, the Torah tells us, was Hur, the son of Miriam, the nephew of Moses and Aaron. You may remember Hur from the battle with Amalek at Rephidim, when Moses stood on the mountaintop and lifted his arms, and the people warring below prevailed. Was this magic? Was this inspiration? We don't know. What we do know is that when the leader lifted his arms, the people lifted their gaze and they found the strength to prevail against their most bitter enemy. But of course, Moses' arms eventually grew weary, and lest the people lose hope when his arms would fall, Aaron and Hur stood on either side of Moses and held up his arms, giving him the strength to continue his faithful prayer and strengthen his people's hearts. So it's perhaps even more tragic, given the story of Hur's heroic spiritual generosity, to consider how this man died. The rabbis in Tractate Sanhedrin explain that he stood up to protest the people's plan to fashion the golden calf. But they, the people, intoxicated by the fantasy of redemption through a golden idol, murdered him with their bare hands. Bezalel, his grandson, was old enough to remember what had happened to his grandfather. Hur's murder is inherited trauma. Pay attention to this. The rabbis are indicating that it was precisely because Bezalel was the inheritor of trauma that he was able to develop the moral and creative imagination to write a new story for the people, to create something beautiful and holy, to plant the possibility of healing in a landscape of heartache and sorrow. It makes me wonder, could this time of so much heartache, could the inherited and ongoing trauma that we are all witnessing and experiencing also open us up to what might be possible? What if all this heartache could awaken in our time an audacious imagination, a mandate to craft that new story? Listen to Rami Elchanan, whose beloved daughter Smadar was murdered in a suicide bombing on Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem some years ago. He writes the following: "When Yitzhak Frankenthal, founder of the Bereaved Families Forum, recruited me 25 years ago, for the first time in my life, I was exposed to the very existence of the other side. I'm ashamed to say," he writes, "that I was 47 years old when I saw for the first time Palestinians as normal human beings, just like me, with the same pain and the same tears and the same dreams. For the first time, I was exposed to the story, the pain, and the anger, and to the nobility and the humanity of what we call the other side. Rami's dearest friend and partner in the work is Bassam Aramim, a Palestinian whose beloved daughter Abir was shot in the head by Israeli border policemen. Their relationship is beyond the conflict, it said. They are brothers in a battle to preserve life. These two and so many more are telling a new story. Like Bezalel, many of the authors of this story being written today have witnessed and they have experienced the deepest and most personal losses. They are drawing from the depths of profound inherited trauma. And they are insistent that a new narrative must be written, a story of a beautiful, safe, dignified future for everyone in that land, Israelis and Palestinians. In the storm of storms, in the year of darkness, it was my heart that spoke out and said, I can't break anymore. I don't have it in me. When we get to the point that we can't break anymore, what happens then? This is how my beloved friend, Rabbi Tamara Lad Applebaum, put it this week. There is no victory here. Gaza is destroyed. Israel is destroyed. The only question is, from the ruins, can we create something different? And I believe that that is the question that we all must answer. We must not evade or avoid or escape, but we must ask, can we create something different? Here's how I'm going to start. I'm going to tell a story from this point on, not only of heartache, but a story of hope. Because in truth, that story is already alive in me too. So the next time a journalist asks me, tell me, Rabbi, what is a typical day in your life? Well, I might say, my heart fills with hope when I wake up and open my WhatsApp and see that my nephew's close friend Nadav, who was nearly killed in a car ramming attack in Ra'anana last month, is now out of the ICU. He's speaking again slowly, and he may be able to get his tracheotomy removed in a few weeks. I'm filled with hope when I read that Sally Abed, Palestinian citizen of Israel and co-leader of a Jewish-Palestinian solidarity movement for peace, whom we will hear from in just an hour or so, has been elected to Haifa's city council. My heart, it swells with hope when I reflect on the Palestinian restaurant owner in Brooklyn who opened his doors to host more than 1,300 Jews for a free community Shabbat dinner, an opportunity to share stories and embrace diverse perspectives and celebrate, he said, our shared humanity. I dare to hope when just before Shabbat, I learned that more than a dozen families of the 134 still held captive in Gaza were shown signs of life of their loved ones, meaning that our deepest prayers might yet be fulfilled and they might be returned home to their families. I hold hope when I hear about the Jews living in Jerusalem who plan to stand at Sha'ar Shechem, the gates to the old city in Jerusalem, to greet people on their way to Ramadan services this coming week, and then give them sweet dates and blessings on their way out as they head to break the fast. And I hold great hope when Rabbi Tamar tells me that she was received lovingly at an interfaith conference in Dubai last week. Together, rabbis and imams and sheikhs and pastors visited the Abrahamic Family House, a joint prayer complex for Muslims, Jews, and Christians in Abu Dhabi, where Tamar shared with the group that it was her dream to build just such a place in Jerusalem. Hearing this, a sheikh approached her and said, "There is already a place exactly like this in Jerusalem, the holy city, but it has yet to be discovered. Continue on your path and keep shining until it is found." There is already a redemptive story that is being written, a story of peace and healing, a story of love and dignity and justice. It is our work to make sure that that story is not drowned out by the story of heartache and devastation and destruction and despair. Together, we, you and I, and all of us must lay to rest that old story, a story of callousness and cruelty, dehumanization, and devaluation. And in its place, we, you and I, can lay the foundation for a new story, one in which we see and honor and affirm one another's humanity, one in which we build together a world worthy of our children. From the depths of our heartache, I hope that we will choose hope. Shabbat shalom.
Hi, it's Rabbi Brass again. Thank you so much for listening. Want more content like this? I hope you'll subscribe. And please consider making a contribution to IKAR so we can continue to work toward the fulfillment of our mission to reanimate Jewish life, to embody moral courage, to nurture the spirit, and to work to decipher what it means to be a human being in the world today. Visit our website at IKAR.org. That's IKAR.org. And I hope to see you, maybe even in person, sometime soon.